Like to bring the Environment and Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committee to order. Representative Rarick, do you want to move the minutes of February 18th?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Director Jasky, welcome. Understand your presentation you don't think will take the whole time, but I'm anticipating numerous questions, so if we don't get done in time, I understand we can stay the next hour because there's no Ag Committee, but no, we're going to be done by 10 o'clock. So. Welcome, Director. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. John Jasky, Executive Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And I'm here today to walk through our budget proposal for the coming biennium, and I'm going to give a little bit of background, some of which you may have recalled seeing in a prior agency overview, but I think I'll go through that rather quickly and make sure we have plenty of time for questions on the items in the budget, as well as a couple of other items that are still in play and development. As mentioned previously, our agency business model is to work through local organizations, local governments specifically. The Soil and Water Conservation Districts, Water Districts, and counties are the primary agents, although we also have various responsibilities with cities in the metropolitan area and even some townships in some places where we work with them on wetland issues as well as some of the clean water work. As I mentioned, our agency is small in terms of employees. We have about 105 or so employees. We use the many capable staff at the local level in those various local government organizations. We also have a number of agreements with non-government organizations, conservation groups specifically, Minnesota Conservation Corps of, Conservation Corps of Minnesota and Iowa is one of them, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, and others have helped us through contractual agreements to deliver conservation at the local level. Our focus is on the private lands of Minnesota. We don't do much work, if any, on public land. That's left to, of course, the public agencies that manage our forests and other wildlife lands and so forth, the DNR and the Forest Service primarily. We occasionally have an intersection where those two types of land ownership come together, but by and large, our focus is on the private land areas. We have a board that consists of local officials, watershed district, soil and water district, county commissioners, citizens, and also the agencies that we partner with at the state level are on the board, DNR, PCA, Ag, Health, and the University of Minnesota. And you can see that those members, they're appointed by the governor onto four-year terms, and they're, you know, required to be dispersed around the state to some extent, including a requirement that a number of them are from the metropolitan area and the others are from anywhere in the state with some expectation of geographic distribution. And they serve four-year terms, as I mentioned, and they provide the governance for the organization, for the agency. They do the sub-appropriations for grants. They set policies in terms of rulemaking and so forth. So they have the authority, you know, to approve those local plans that drive the actions and the work of our local partners. Another thing that I'll mention that I didn't highlight already is the fact that we work a lot of our effort towards getting alignment of state, local, and federal resources for conservation work on the ground. We spend a good bit of time with the USDA agencies. We also spend time with the Corps of Engineers, making sure that their programs and ours are working as efficiently as they can to get the work done that we have in common. We mentioned already the responsibility to oversee and implement, to oversee and approve the implementation of local water management plans, and I'll come back to that topic a little bit further down the road. We are proposing a couple of changes in that area, and that would be consistent with things that have happened in the past, and I think the move towards a watershed approach is really something that this committee has heard before, and we expect to further that in this upcoming legislative session. I'll also highlight the Wetland Conservation Act. There's a couple of things we're working on in that area. The issue of drainage is always before us, and we have the responsibility to coordinate the drainage work group and some of the policy and implementation items that have come out of their recommendations. But there aren't any specific things to that in this proposal. Core functions, again, we've worked with private landowners using local technical staff primarily. Those functions, you know, have to do with getting conservation on the ground as a general category of work. I mentioned already the coordination between the federal, state, and local level to make sure that the funding and the responsibilities are aligned on those private land endeavors. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will start to walk into the budget details, a little bit of them anyway, and certainly if members have more questions about the specifics, I'd be happy to go into those as well. This pie chart shows the governor's proposed budget for Bowser for the upcoming biennium. You can see here that the largest amount of the funding is actually in the Clean Water Fund, because that's the projects and practices that are used to achieve clean water objectives. Another pie chart that I'm not going to show you, which I showed you previously, is that somewhere between 85% and 90% of these funds go out to local governments, to projects and practices that are necessary to achieve conservation goals in those plans that I described earlier. The four categories here, the miscellaneous revenue is really the federal funding that we sometimes pass through the agency, although much more of the federal funding goes directly to landowners, and it wouldn't come through our budget, so you wouldn't see it as a budget item, but it's certainly something that we do a lot of work to align with and utilize those federal funds to the utmost.
Excuse me, Director. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Jenich. I didn't quite catch it. 90% of the clean water funds go to local governments? Is that what I heard?
Mr. Director, Jaskin.
Chairman, members, yes, 90% of the clean water funds dollars go out to local governments for projects on the ground, and 85% of all the other funding does the same, takes the same path. So of the general fund dollars, for example, about 19% of our total budget, you know, 85% of that goes to local governments for their projects and practice work.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Jashke. How much of that pie chart is outdoor heritage, or is that in a different pie chart?
Director Jashke.
Mr. Chairman and members, none of this pie chart includes, nothing in this pie chart includes Outdoor Heritage Fund, LCCMR funding or bonding, which are other revenue sources that are used for some of our work. But this is part of the governor's budget, so we're presenting just that here today. I can certainly give you those numbers if you're interested.
Go ahead. I'll let Representative Hansen go first. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that would be helpful just to give us some context, I think, because I think there's buffer money in the clean water recommendations, but, Mr. Chair, we had about $5 or $6 million in buffer money in outdoor heritage. Is that?
Director Jaskie, do you have those numbers?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, we have three specific line items in the outdoor heritage bill. There's $4.544 million for buffers, for riparian buffers, you know, along water courses and other water bodies. There's $1.6 million for easements. These are all for easements, by the way. Conservation easements through our Reinvested Minnesota program. For protection of highly sensitive wild rice areas in some of the Cisco lakes in north central Minnesota, and $1.5 million for conservation easements around Camp Ripley, the Army compatible use buffer area that has been established there for the last half dozen or more years. So those are the three items in the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Well, I'm talking about
them. Jaskie, yeah. You elaborated on the second and third one. The first one, could you just give us a little more context? Is it statewide initiative, and exactly, I thought you said it was RIM, but I might have missed it, if you could elaborate.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, all three of the items in the Outdoor Heritage Fund proposal are Reinvested Minnesota RIM easements. The first of them, which I didn't cover in quite so much detail, was for riparian buffers along water courses and water bodies to some extent. And that we would hope to continue the alignment with the Clean Water Fund. It's the one program in the state where we have two constitutionally dedicated funds, Clean Water and Outdoor Heritage, working side by side to make sure that we get both clean water and habitat benefits on the same project. The way that program works is that we take an easement that includes typically the first 100 feet or so, which is for the clean water aspect, and then where the habitat value is also present or could be present if the proper plans and design is accomplished, we would get an additional wider buffer for the habitat value. So we end up with one easement with two constitutionally separate funds of course, makes the accounting more interesting than otherwise it might be, but that's okay. We're doing that just fine, I think. There will be a one easement, two sources of money, and two public purposes on that site.
And Director Jasky, remind the committee, this is private land. Willing landowner stays in private property. They pay, continue to pay taxes. They control the access to the land, but it is protection for erosion and such. And so what kind of cover crop would be on that land?
Mr. Chairman, you pretty much described it. I'll add one more thing. On the cover crop, it's typically a permanent native planting that we put in place, and the landowner has a responsibility to maintain it. We oftentimes get some help if they need it, but it's, you know, the usual don't cut it or hay it or anything like that until after a wildlife habitat date that's been set and that plan has been reached. You know, burning only for conservation purposes, things like that. But yes, it's privately owned, privately controlled. I'll add one more thing. You know, with this program we've had in place now for about 4 years, I believe, this combination of habitat and clean water, and we've had, you know, tremendous demand, and only been able to, I think we had, you know, 80 or more applicants in a couple of week period, and we were only able to fund, I think, about 10 of them. So it's highly, it's high demand and high benefit both, I would say.
And Director Jasky, and I know Representative Hansen wants to weigh in here too, and he's next, but if I'm not mistaken, both Representative Hansen and I have worked hard on Lessard Sams to try and get more money to it, because I personally like the idea of emerging those two programs, and it's voluntary with private landowners doing the kind of program, some of what the governor talked about in the Pheasant Summit, but you're already doing it with private landowners that are willing to participate. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was going to follow up on that or anticipate that the committee should know that in the first round of this, actually, this received zero funding. And Representative McNamara, Chair McNamara, myself, and Ron Shera actually got the $3 million in there with some difficulty, but we received that. And so other folks may have wanted fee title acquisition for other properties, but this was out of the $100 million getting $3 million into the buffers. And my reason for originally starting the question is, if we're looking at a lot of money from clean water for buffers and a little bit of money for outdoor heritage for buffers. And the point you made, Director Jasky, is that there is demand. There's folks who want to sign up. There are farmers who want to sign up for this. But the money hasn't been there. So I think this has been something on a bipartisan basis that we've been able to actually try to get some funds for those folks who want to enroll, and then they have the flexibility. It could be 100 feet, or it could be the side inlets, or it could be a variety of things based on the topography of the area. Mm-hmm. But we're not funding it as much as we could. And maybe that's something we can look at.
Well, and I think for members on both sides of the aisle to know that this is, many of us have advocated for more of outdoor heritage money to go to this kind of work. Some people feel the only money should be spent where the public continues to have access to the land, and the reality, we have a lot of private property in Minnesota that should stay in private property ownership, and the reality, the critters move from the public to the private land, and if we can get some of the critters growing on the private land, they're going to move around a little bit. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just on that, I'd add, we don't want access to that land when it's down in our lakes and streams, so we like to keep it up where it's at. My question, Director Jasky, in the pie chart, the one, I think that's the one that's still up there, and the federal share, and I don't want to talk about the percent share, but the dollar amount that's come from the feds, where's that been over the last 10, 15 years?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Purcell, it's variable, you know, particularly the federal farm bill funds, which, you know, are re-upped at least average about every 5 years, and they change those programs each time, it seems like, both in terms of their focus and their funding availability, and to some extent what kind of matching requirements or something similar to that you can expect. They provided that funding in two ways. They provided in financial assistance or money to a landowner to enroll their land, and they also provided through technical assistance to local governments, so water districts specifically, to help make those projects happen. You know, if I had to just pick a number out of the air, I think it's probably been, you know, about a 50-50, you know, split over the whole 10 or 15 years you described and over both of those categories.
Representative Purcell. Oh, you're done. Okay. Thank you. Continue on, Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I should just mention, too, that, you know, as you described, there are, Representative Hansen maybe described that there are two other things that aren't in the governor's budget, which, of course, is the Outdoor Heritage, the LCCMR. We also have, there's three items in that legislation moving forward that it's, one of them is for easements, the other is for cover crops. Mr. Chairman, you described that, a new initiative to try and get cover crops on land that is in production so we can manage the erosion and other pollutant possibilities that would otherwise happen off of that land. And we also have a proposal in for Farm Bill assistance, which is really aligned with what Representative Purcell talked about, and that is delivering the technical assistance to individual landowners who want to enroll in a program, an easement or a contract or some other conservation opportunity that's on their property, that they've got to have some help from the Soil and Water District or one of our NGO partners to get that work accomplished. This just shows the same number, same amounts of money in the various activity categories, and I'll walk through it a little bit more specifically. You can see that the Clean Water Fund, that large amount of money, is really put into a local water management work area because that funding goes from the agency to local governments to implement the top couple of things in their local water management plans that we ask them to submit to us each and every year, and I'll show you another chart a little bit later about the demand and the supply that's in that category.
Excuse me, Director. Representative Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Director Jasky. Just a quick question on this pie chart. On your administrative and agency costs at 7%, has that remained pretty much constant the last number of years in the number of FTEs?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ugel, I'll come back to that FTE question as I slide a little bit later on that talks about that, so it may be easier just to cover it all there if you wouldn't mind.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Continue, Director Jasky.
So, you know, there's these budget categories, and I'll just cover those real quickly. Responsibility to oversee the laws and rules of the state is one of our responsibilities that we pass on in partnership with local governments. These are those categories of work. The Wetland Conservation Act protects wetlands. The drainage law assures that the drainage infrastructure is well managed and with conservation purposes also factored in. We have a natural resources block grant, which we provide to county governments, and they pass on some of that to soil and water conservation districts to manage water, to do their shoreland zoning program, to carry out their feedlot regulatory authorities, and similarly with their sewage treatment systems. These programs are overseen in the case of feedlots and sewage treatment systems by the PCA, and the DNR oversees the shoreland management, and we oversee the wetland conservation. But what we do is we bundle state funding that pays for part, and it's a fraction of the work that these local governments do to carry out these state programs. So. It's been helpful for them to get a block grant so they can use the money a little bit more flexibly. It's administratively efficient, and then they cover these programs and report back their work to the state.
Director Jasky, could you go back to that slide? I'd like to talk a little bit about the first two bullets, Wetland Conservation Act and drainage law. You have people, you're going to get into the FTE, so if you want me to wait, this kind of relates to where your people are located throughout the state, and how do they do this enforcement, and what about the potential if we're, the governors raise the awareness that maybe current drainage law aren't being equitably enforced across the state. Would you rather have that discussion later when you talk about the FTEs and where they are, or do you want to have that now?
Maybe I can cover at least part of it now. The FTE part I didn't have broken down into all these categories, so maybe we can either do that for you later, or I can, we'll come to it and have a longer discussion if necessary. But As you mentioned, we have staff in various places around the state, regional offices. I think we've got 9 of them. We are co-located with other agencies in all of those places. The Wetland Conservation Act is administered by local governments, by counties, cities. In some cases, stormwater conservation districts have been delegated the authority. And there's a process where, you know, they a landowner, come in and, you know, get a decision about whether they are able to impact a wetland or not, and if they are able to, whether they have to do some mitigation for that impact and offset it somewhere else. And we built systems to do all of that. The drainage law, we have technical experts that help with that. We have an administrative appeal processes if someone feels aggrieved by a local decision, so they don't have to go to court. They can go to an administrative appeal, which is more user-friendly and cheaper, certainly. You don't have to have a lawyer. You can get one if you want. So that law has been around since 1991, and I think over time we've been able to demonstrate that there's a very careful combination of local and state work to get good decisions and make sure our wetlands are protected, because they are one of our most important ways of achieving conservation. They provide multiple benefits: habitat, water quality, flood retention, and so on and so forth.
Director Jasky, so, like, what kind of expertise? You've got these people out in a field office or co-located with MPCA or DNR, somebody out in a field office somewhere, and you've got this man or woman out traveling around working with local farmers about potentially enrolling their private property in programs, and then they drive by and see something like, whoa, I should talk to this individual. They should be in a program. What they got going on here might not even quite fit under current law. So how do those conversations take place? And then, because you're somebody that your people, when I say you are someone, your people are out there already working with these folks. I got a feeling if they see a Bowser vehicle come up in the driveway, it's not quite the red flags of the MPCA or the DNR, and I'd like to ask you specifically, so how does that work? So they're coming to these people. Do they stop by if they see something that's not right? Do they reach out to them? They may already know them, or not necessarily, or what? If you could elaborate.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, you know, to the individual landowner, they're much, much, much more likely to encounter a local government person doing that work, you know, that we've provided some help with. They're likely to encounter a county person or a soil and water conservation district person or a water district person than they are to encounter an agency person from our shop.
Director Jasky, I'm sorry, but can you tell just the committee, you just talked about 4 different people and who they are. Pretend you're, the Purcell or McNamara farm out in Traverse County, and so who are these 4 people? Who do they work for? Where did they come from? And so somebody, say he's a new young farmer on the ground, or her. What agencies do these folks work for? What part of government?
Well, let's use Traverse County then, since you brought it up as an example, and they would be the same in most places. If it's in, you know, Traverse County, very rural, of course. Wheaton is the only town of any size, a county seat. But they would, if they saw a problem, someone saw a problem, or if someone had a problem they wanted solved for their own purposes, they would probably start with the Soil and Water Conservation District in that county. They are often co-located with the USDA staff in the same county seat, and they could either help them or tell them where to go get the help. If they saw a problem, then of course, if it was a drainage issue, it would either be, you know, depending, Traverse County, it's likely the Watershed District, the Boyd & Sioux Watershed District covers basically all of that county.
Director Jasky, who does the SWCD, who do they work for? What kind of background would be this person coming out on the ground? I'm really asking for a basic understanding, because this, we're talking about a number of different people that may come down the driveway, and your agency, SWCDs, watersheds, are some of the most likely folks to come, and they tend to have better reception, I believe, and I want to encourage these kind of people, and I want the folks in the committee to understand, because we talk here about MPCA and DNR and you just a little bit, but I think the folks they're more likely to run into are these, and it seems like they're better accepted by the landowner. So who do the SWCD work for, and where, for instance, are they office?
Yeah, their office, they work for a local elected board, the Soil and Water Conservation District Board that every county has, and people vote for them every election. They serve, you know, terms like any other elected official does. And then they employ staff to do that technical work. And they're typically, you know, hydrologists or engineers or biologists. You know, they have that kind of training, very similar to what a state agency field person would have. They happen to work for a local government. The county, you know, they also have land use zoning authority, so you might encounter someone, need a building permit, or you've done something that's in the right-of-way, you know, of a road or something, you would have to get a permit for that. It would likely come from the county planning and zoning office, and they're, of course, employed by the elected county board. The watershed districts, which aren't everywhere in the state, are special purpose organizations set up with taxing authority, and they employ people as staff and or oftentimes as contractors. Actually, all of them employ contractors, too, to do. In the case of Traverse County, their primary mission is to manage flooding. They also do some work, or actually quite a bit of work now, in drainage as well, because the two are very much connected. You know, if the water's being moved from one place to another, that can cause consequences for flooding. So, and they're all local. The watershed district is appointed people from the county board appoints to do that work, and they hire the people that are going to carry it out. The common denominator among all of them is they have a plan of action that I'll talk more about later that binds their work together. So, you know, if you're in Traverse County, you know, the Bois de Sioux River is one watershed in that county that you would have a plan for, and we're proposing that we're going to have watershed plans for every place in this state over the next 10 years. So that's the action plan they use. The local people who are doing the work and working with landowners are employed locally, and they use local contractors and so forth to do some of those projects or most of those projects. So, and they have a, you know, a responsibility to the state in two ways. One is, you know, the state provides funding through our agency and perhaps others. And number two, the state approves their local water plan to make sure that it's got, you know, enough oversight and objectivity that it's going to do the job that people believe needs to be done.
And Director Jaski, would these be people that may be, I think of the NRCS office in Morris, I believe they have some, I don't know if their authority extends up to Traverse County or not, but do they commingle these people in a local NRCS office like that, or are they more apt to be in a, could they also be at the county courthouse?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they could be. There are, you know, it's up to each local district to figure out how they're going to, you know, have a roof over their head and equipment to use, but it's usually a combination or some combination of working in the courthouse or working in the USDA office, or in some cases they're you know, in another county building someplace, and so they're co-located locally on, in almost every case that I can think of. Okay. They share equipment, they share information. Of course, USDA information is private, so they got to be careful that they don't share that kind of information, but they can share, you know, facts. They just can't share individual landowner details with someone outside of USDA unless the landowner gives them permission, and we may come back to that topic later.
Thank you. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jaski. We're talking about taxpayer money. And a question that had come up is, with as many grants that are being written, you know, across the state of Minnesota, there have been some cases allegedly of grant fraud taking place. And I wanted to know if you were familiar with the feedlot in Wabasha, where a grant allegedly was put together and they had fraudulently indicated the volume of animals and things of that sort. And I just want to know that when these monies are being divvied out, what are the things we're doing to prevent situations like this from potentially happening?
Director Jaski, if it's an ongoing lawsuit, I don't want to get either you or I in trouble. Director Jaski, yeah. I don't even know. I'm not familiar with the incident.
Mr. Chairman, there isn't a lawsuit. Actually, we're working on a remedy which is based on the fact that these grant agreements have conditions for performance in them. And in the example you gave, a former employee of the county we believe, did some of the things you described. The projects got built. They just didn't get in a final conclusion at this point anyway, a certification that they were built to spec. So we have to make sure. Our granite condition says they have to be built to specifications, you know, signed off by an engineer in this case. And that employee left the state and wasn't found again, apparently, before they got the engineer to sign off on all that. So we are working on that, resolving that one. And you're right, there's thousands, and we have very careful protocol for grant agreements. Sometimes, you know, we get reminded that, you know, following up on all these details and reporting and so forth is work, too. You know, we need to take that into account. But we have audits that we are subject to from the legislative auditor. We have all the local governments are subject to audits by the state auditor, too, so it's almost a double review. And then we have staff. We do have staff that aren't hydrologists, engineers, and biologists. We have some fiscal oversight staff whose job it is to make sure that the work that is being done in those agreements is being done financially correct as well as technically correct. So there's a lot of them, so there's a few things that always have a few rough edges, and we've got to make sure we keep that to a minimum.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, just wondering, I'm assuming that this is a very rare situation, that this isn't something that happens on a regular basis. Is this like maybe the only case of issue like this coming up? I'm assuming there must be some, but how often does something like this occur?
Director Jansky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Heinzman, this is the only one currently. I mean, it could happen again, but it's the only one currently where we've got to kind of reconcile the county's responsibilities in the grant agreement that they signed with the state of Minnesota and then their agreements with this individual, or especially two landowners involved. And it wasn't the landowner's fault, so we're in that situation where we don't want to penalize someone for something they didn't cause. There was allegedly a rogue employee, and the courts and others will maybe take some action on that. That's not our part of it. Our job is to make sure the money was well spent and that the project is going to be sustainable.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jasky, you had meant, we're going to go back just a little bit. I was going to wait, but I think I'll do it now. You had talked about watersheds authority to tax. Do all watersheds have the authority to tax? And if they do, where do they get that authority? And what is the process that they do to either raise or gain a tax?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, watershed districts have the authority to levy based on statutory authorities for that work or for that responsibility. They do it through the county process. They're part of the, you know, they use the county system for the levy and the collection. That levy is capped at a $250,000 amount for the administrative work that they have to do. They have the ability for special projects to levy a bit more in some cases, but it all goes through the same process that the county levy does, you know, through the taxation hearings and so on and so forth. And they publish the information on their website about what they use the funding for, and they have to send reports to the state about their performance against their plan. It's variable, you know. I mean, they don't all use the full authority. Some of them just, you know, from year to year, depending on what they have in their plan and the work they're going to do, they adjust that amount. So it's a little bit case by case. But I can give you more details. Any one watershed district, if you're looking for that at some point down the road.
Director Jasky, do they all have the authority?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they all have the authority.
And Director Jasky, how many WMOs have taxing authority? And maybe you can just tell us quick the difference, and then I'm going to go back to Representative Green.
Mr. Chairman, the WMO, or Watershed Management Organization, is a creation in statute that is only applicable in the seven-county metropolitan area based on a law that was passed in 1982. And that WMO is a joint powers authority rather than a, you know, another government entity. They don't have taxing authority unless provided specifically in statute. And I believe there are two that have that, two of the 16 or so that exist. The others are just the joint powers of cities, you know, and or townships in some case. The And there's also, this is gets a little more complicated without a map, but there are also a few that are run by a county government, Scott County and Carver County, because the local cities and townships, you know, didn't want to do it themselves. So that's a kind of a long answer to a short question, but the WMOs are only in the metropolitan area, and they don't have taxing authority unless they're given it specifically in statute.
Representative Green, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think you did answer my question. I just want to make it clear so that I had it right in my mind. The watershed districts have authority to a certain point, but if they want to raise a levy, they have to go through the process like a township would, where you go to back to the people and ask to get that raised, they can't just go out and say we want to tax and levy it. Is that correct?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, they have an authority to institute a levy based on their plan up to that cap that's statutorily, you know, limited. So sometimes they go to the cap, sometimes they don't. And they have some other authorities that to do special projects. You can imagine if you're doing, in Red River Valley, you know, there's multi-million dollar flood control projects that they have to come up with the resources for. And some of that money does come from their local levy. And of course, some comes from other sources too, the state or federal government primarily. But it varies year to year. They go through the same process the county does to announce their levy and hold hearings on it. It's all done as a bundled package with the county.
Director Jaski, they don't need voter referendum for the authority up to 250, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Continue on.
Just to mention, you had asked about the drainage law. We have our chief engineer, Al Kane, he leads the drainage work group. That law, we don't have a great deal of field presence because the local authorities, in the case of the drainage systems, it's the counties and watershed districts that implement that law, and they're responsible for that infrastructure and the legal provisions that go with that. So our work is really in the more centralized in respect to carrying out that program. This just shows a trend, or at least the amounts of funding in those three categories that have, looking back five biennium, or actually looking back four biennium, and then looking ahead. There's no change proposed here, so you see the current biennium and the next biennium being exactly the same in terms of dollar amounts. I mentioned local water management already.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Jaski. On the drainage assistance, it seems there's some past grants to do updating the drainage manual, mm-hmm. and for training of viewers. Could you maybe talk about the manual, and I think that's special revenue, and it might be good for the committee on viewers, not inspectors, but how many mm-hmm. viewers we have out there and how they're trained.
Director Jess.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen is describing the drainage law, Minnesota statutes, Chapter 103E, and that law has been around for a century and a quarter at least, and it was put in place to be able to drain the landscape for production purposes, by and large. And that law has not changed a lot. There's been a little bit of court, interpretation of it over the years. One of the things that was deemed useful back 20 some years ago was a manual that described for practitioners, how to work through these somewhat arcane pieces of statute and proceedings to make sure that drainage infrastructure is properly designed, paid for, and maintained. That manual was obviously very old and needed to be updated, and so as Representative Hansen indicated, there was some special funding provided through the LCCMR and through Clean Water Funds to do that update, and that work is underway as we speak. Contractors have been hired to do that along with a group of agency and local government personnel that are overseeing that update. We also, as part of our responsibilities, are required to keep an inventory of where buffer strips are required. In buffer strips on drainage law are a one rod or 16 and a half foot requirement. When a new ditch or a ditch has gone through something called a redetermination of benefits, that law was passed in 1977, so any ditch system or part of a ditch system that has had a redetermination of benefits since that year has a requirement to put a one-rod grass strip on either side of the ditch. So, you know, what we've seen with this reporting now has been, you know, required since, I think, maybe 8-9 years ago. About 20% of all ditches have a responsibility to have a buffer. The other 80%, there is no requirement to have a buffer at all. There are, of course, some, as you were describing earlier, where people have voluntarily enrolled land in an easement or other program to put a buffer in, but a required buffer exists only on 20% of ditch systems in this state. So that's what the current law requires. And the way a buffer strip, along with all the other aspects of a ditch system, are evaluated in this redetermination is they send out a team of people called viewers to look at the land and make a judgment about what landowners are going to get in terms of benefit parcel by parcel and what the costs are going to be on that same ditch system or partial ditch system. And the engineering is done, and then the costs are dispersed among the parties that are benefiting from that drainage system. It's like a mini watershed, if you want to think of it that way. The viewing process is unique, I'll say, and the problem with that we're having now is that there aren't very many people that know how to do it, and most of them are, you know, elderly already, and trying to get some people to take on that work has been a bit of a challenge. I do believe there's an opportunity to use technology to do that a lot more cost effectively, and there might be some. I know the Greenwich Work Group has been looking at what that could be, because right now, you know, the law says you can only do it this way. You can't use LIDAR data. You can't use some of the county parcelization information that's now in their GIS systems that they use for taxation purposes and things. So there's room for improvement there, I think, in terms of efficiency. But currently we've got to work with what the current law requires.
Director Jaski, a follow-up to that. So this redetermination of benefit, is that done when a ditch needs, somebody's said maybe this ditch needs some work? What? Why would you do a redetermination? Is that to have the authority to spend some money, or why is that done?
Mr. Smith, good question. I didn't cover that. A redetermination of benefits happens for a couple of triggers. One is a petition can be filed by the beneficiaries of the current system, and one of the common ways that, or common reasons for that, is that if this ditch was established, you know, in the 20s or something, you know, 100 years have passed, it's very likely that more land has been brought into that ditch system that wasn't originally included in the benefited area. So people are putting water into the system that, you know, 100 years ago or 80 years ago couldn't, because they didn't have the same technology. Now you can put drain tile, you know, in a lot of places that previously weren't able to. So you have more people now in the system than you had before, because they hadn't been paying anything at all, and so now they're included. It could be that the ditch is going to be improved. You're going to make the ditch a little deeper, a little wider, a little greater capacity. That's another reason for a redetermination to be commenced, and you have to put those costs back on all the beneficiaries. Those are the typical triggers.
And Director Jaski, who has the authority, and how is that put back? Is that on their taxes, or do they just send a note out to them, this is what you owe? How's that work?
Mr. Chairman, it could be either, but typically it's an assessment, and I think they all do it more or less the same. They send a bill. If they don't, they can use the tax system to do it as well, but it's an assessment like you get for a street improvement or something else in a municipal area.
Director Jaski, I'm thinking of one I saw where it was had been lined with big, huge cottonwoods that I would say had been let to grow for, you know, they had to be 50 years old. I'm sure some of them were, so it was pretty extensive work to go in. Would this be the kind of thing, would it take redetermination to go in? This was like a couple mile stretch of great big huge cottonwoods that were taken down. Would that be to make the ditch function better? And is there any responsibility, should the landowner, are they responsible to control deciduous tree growth on the ditch, and they just didn't do it, or are they not responsible to do that?
Mr. Chairman, the landowners are typically not responsible for it, although, you know, some of them are given, you know, so informal permission to do it anyway. The ditch system itself, the trustee of the ditch system, which is either the county board or the watershed district board is the one that's responsible for that, and they're supposed to do that and then, you know, put the any costs on that back to all of those who are benefiting. In the case of tree removal, that typically is just a maintenance project, so you're just cleaning the ditch out or you're taking out trees or things like that. That would not trigger a redetermination of benefits ordinarily. Now, there's a certain threshold where it might, and that's something that the petition process and the ditch authority would, you know, use the laws currently to make that decision. But most of the time, it would not be a redetermination, just be a maintenance project.
And the ditches are owned by who?
Mr. Chairman, the ditches are owned, if you want to think of it that way, in a trust, basically, in Minnesota. Minnesota is a little bit different than other places. We have, by law, in this statute 103E, county boards, watershed district boards, or joint county boards, just depending on how the ditch was built, because some ditches are all within a county, and they're, the county board does it as a separate responsibility from their county board business. So we have a public local government as the trustee of these systems. You know, other states, you know, Iowa, for example, they have private trusts that run these drainage systems, so they're a little bit different, but it's the same concept where the trust is managed and they have to pay for all the costs, and in theory they've already, you know, they get the benefits go along with those costs. And it's really about infrastructure management. It's not about, you know, they're not in the business of doing flood control or water quality or conservation. They're set up in the statute to do infrastructure management.
And Director Jaski, you're talking about public ditches, so I just wanted to let folks know that public ditches are not the private property owner that's, generally speaking, farming alongside of them, doesn't own to the middle of the ditch and the other side is owned by somebody else or maybe the same property owner. They're actually publicly owned by an entity. Director Jaski.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and owned is a, I'm not a real estate expert, but
maybe an easement?
Yeah, they have control. They have de facto control. And when they do a redetermination and do have to put the buffer strip in, then they do acquire some property interest to make sure they have access for the future. But of course, some of these were done, you know, many years ago, and they didn't acquire those same property interests. And but they have effective control over that ditch system as a public ditch. And you're right there, Mr. Chairman. There are a lot of systems that are drainage that have drainage benefits that are not part of a public ditch system.
And Director Jaski and to the members, I'm kind of diving into this for a number of different reasons. One, the governor has brought ditches higher on the radar screen. Iowa has brought ditches on the radar screen. It's in one of the daily papers this morning. I read the article, the Des Moines water area, the treatment that supplies the drinking water to the city of Des Moines, Iowa, is I don't think they've entered the lawsuit yet, but they're considering entering a lawsuit against either three counties to the north or three drainage areas to the north that they're claiming that they have some responsibility to pay for the drinking water treatment that's needed in Iowa, and the talk is that is Minnesota next. So I think it's important that we have some of these discussions. So thank you, Director. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Jaski. The other purpose I hope you have is to help folks like me learn about this, and I appreciate the line of questioning. And I just want to make sure I heard you correctly. After the redetermination, did I understand that there is the requirement that there be the buffer, the one-rod buffer, for all ditches that are redetermined and the benefits?
Director Jaski.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, that is true.
And along with that, there is no requirement if there's not a redetermination. And 80% of the ditches, of the public ditches in Minnesota, have not had redetermination since that 1977 or whatever that year you mentioned earlier, Director Jaski. So when you hear this talk about, well, they don't have the required grass on the ditch, most ditches don't have a requirement, and some have the 16.5 foot or the rod distance we use, and some ditches actually have a 50-foot requirement. So it is confusing not only to the public but to the landowner themselves. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. One more clarification. I would like a somebody to explain to me the difference between the private and the public ditches.
Director Jaskin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the private ditch doesn't really have a definition. It's just one where somebody dug something, or, you know, possibly even a natural channel was, you know, dug to get better drainage to it, straightened it out, or dug it deeper. It's there's no legal definition of it. It's it was very ad hoc. You know, a couple of landowners got together and said, hey, how about if we, you know, straighten this creek or dig this thing deeper to get the water off our property? And if they agreed to do it, the handshake was all it took, and that's what happened. And then, you know, to some extent, they have to keep the handshake going to keep the thing maintained. Now, there's different laws in some cases that come along that may require a regulatory review of it, but not many, if any. A public ditch system is created and managed under state statute, under Minnesota Statute 103E, and it creates, you know, the responsibility of the trustee, the county board, or the watershed district board, or the joint board, to figure out who's going to benefit, who's going to pay, and to keep the thing working.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. One more question. Then I see a lot of ditches, obviously, where I live, and any ballpark, what percentage are you seeing are private ditches, and how many are public?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, in Nicollet County, I'm going to say the majority by far are public systems, because I believe in Nicollet County, for example, where you represent, there are, most of that area has been petitioned for a public ditch system. But if you go into other parts of the state where there's not as much ditching, or some of the ditching was done, you know, prior to, or, you know, instead of, you know, a public system being built, it's probably more like 50-50, I would say.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Director Jaskie, that 20% number, probably 10 years ago, that was in single digits, because in that time we've had some counties or drainage authorities make the determination that it was a benefit for their landowners to go through and do redeterminations. A systematic redetermination on every system in their county. I think Freeborn County was one of those. And the benefit to the landowners is that if you use the new technology, if they use the viewers and the LIDAR and that, then you get an accurate assessment on the costs and benefits for the drainage system versus the 100-year-old or the 125-year-old paper map that was drawn. And in many cases, those counties, maybe those maps were flooded or burned or are gone. Mm-hmm. So do you have a list of which counties have done a systematic redetermination of benefits and where they're at in that process, or even what you know?
Director Jaskie.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I'll have to ask Al Kane, our chief engineer, to give me a full list, and I'll share that with you. I know that he said Freeborn County has completed it. My understanding is Martin County is in the middle of doing something like that. And, you know, some counties don't have ditches all over their county, so they wouldn't maybe be doing it, you know, countywide. But you're right that it's a legal process, and it took, I believe, Freeborn County 10 years to get through all of their systems. And so, and there's a cost with that, because there's the legal costs, there's some, you know, possibly some engineering work that has to be done. Freeborn County, I don't know exactly what they did, but they were able to use, you know, a dedicated group of viewers to do most of this work. Those same people, you know, can't just get in the car and drive to Thief River Falls and do the same work very well. I mean, they have to be very familiar with the site and the landscape. So I support the idea of technology being added to the mix, because I think we've got an opportunity to do that we didn't have in the century past.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Jaskie. In Freeborn County, when they were doing the redetermination of benefits, did they, when they received the one rod into the system, did they work with federal CRP or state cost share money to maybe go to 100 feet, or work with the landowners on doing the voluntary portion? How did that work?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in Freeborn County, as in other counties, they've given landowners information to allow them to enroll that area into a conservation program of various sorts that are available. The one rod is a little different than the other buffers that are talked about with the 50-foot width under the shoreline zoning, because that also has to be used as an access point. And actually, you know, one rod's not going to do a whole lot for habitat, of course. It will help, you know, stabilize the bank, but it's also needed as an access path for removing trees and doing other maintenance in that system. And it's also used as an area where they, when they clean the ditch, you know, pull the sediment out and pile it up, so letting it dry. They need an area to hold that material for it to be dried and then presumably pushed down to the field when the neighbor allows that to happen. So it's operated much like a utility would operate, right? It's a piece of infrastructure that they're managing for utility purposes. The conservation benefit of the one rod is pretty limited when you think about what else has to happen in that 16.5-foot wide strip.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jaski, thanks for being here. I just want clarification. Did you say that 80% of ditches don't have buffers? And are they public or private?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, that's public systems, because there's no requirement for a buffer on any private system. And of the public systems, 20% have a buffer because they've had to go through a redetermination of benefits since 1977.
Director Jaski, 20% are required to have a 16-foot buffer. Many drainage systems that don't have a requirement for a buffer may have a buffer of varying length or no buffer at all, but it's pretty standard practice. I think it's fair to say that the inslope of the drainage system usually has cover on it. At least it was tried to, or did have established cover at one time, whether some of it's been lost or not. The practice is generally that the inslopes of a drainage ditch would have cover, but there is no requirement if it hasn't had a redetermination, even on the inslope. Is there, Director Jaski, or is there some law that you could make a requirement for them to have cover there? And then I'm going to go back for Representative Fabian. Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there's any, you know, technical requirement to have vegetation on the inside, called the inside slope of the inverse slope of the ditch system. But in all cases, I think they typically do, unless there's a slump or something, because that area needs to be seeded down just for stability. Otherwise, you're going to be cleaning your ditch out so often you can't afford to keep the equipment out there that much. So I don't think that's an issue. I think when you ask about the presence of buffers on the other 80% that don't have a requirement, we don't have any data on that, so it's really hard for me to make an estimate of that.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just two things. Well, first of all, you started talking about this, and I saw Ms. Taylor get up and grab the book, so your answer may be coming. But on the one rod or the 50 feet, where is that measurement actually taken from?
Director Jask.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, for the one rod, it's taken from the crown of the bank, which is the high point of the bank adjacent to the ditch, and laterally from there. The 50 foot is considered to be top of bank as well, and that's a little bit less explicit in that zoning requirement, but the ordinary high water mark is more or less what that is along a river, which is more or less the top of the bank for all practical purposes.
Director Jaski, is there also some reference to the center of the ditch sometimes on where the cover or how wide the buffer is, or is it always from the crown? And maybe I'll ask Ms. Taylor to check the statute, but I thought there was some reference in some of the ditches, and I'll let you go first, and I see Representative Hansen's hand going up. Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any measurement that's a requirement that starts in the center line of a channel, but I could be corrected.
Representative Hansen.
We spent 2 years on this one. We sent it to the work group, and it was counting the angels on that, dancing on the head of a pin. And it came up with the drainage work group, and that this is back in 05 and 06, 07 and 08. That was, because some folks wonder when you have, where does it start? Does it start on the water line, center of the water, middle of the ditch, and you've got construction ditches and ditches that are falling in on themselves. So the consensus agreement was from the crown out.
Okay.
And I think where you're coming from the center of the water line might be properties oftentimes a ditch may be a dividing line, so you may have a property. If you and I own both sides of the ditch, each side of the ditch, it may be that water line that's the property line.
Thank you. To this point, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jaski, on public waters like a river or a stream, where is this? What is the buffer requirement there, and how, where does it start and stop?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, for public waters, or the basic equivalent of the shoreline zoning requirement, it's a 50-foot measurement that would be from what's called the ordinary high water mark, which is more or less the top of a bank on a water course. On a lake, it'd be, you know, more or less the same thing. There's a legal definition for the ordinary high water mark, which is, in, I believe, in statute or certainly in rule. So.
Paula, Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're right. It's a little hard to identify in many cases. What happens, our streams and rivers tend to migrate in major flood events especially. Does that then change the mark?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, yes, it would. When a channel is changes itself, the measurement would potentially change as well.
Follow-up, Representative
Thank
Torkelson.
You, Mr. Chair. So would that change it on both sides? If it moves to the left, would it extend it to the requirement on the left side of the creek and reduce it on the other side?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, that would be from wherever the top of the bank is at the moment that the standard is being applied. So I think you'd use the top of the bank wherever it happens to be at the time that you're making the decision.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, yeah, it's just, it gets a little, mm-hmm. It's hard to be super accurate with these things, I guess is the point mm-hmm. I'm trying to make. That we're working with dynamic systems, and it's not as easily determined as one might think just looking at it.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's fair to say, I also will say that if you have a buffer in place, it's less likely that the channel bank's going to change because the vegetation will hold the bank in place. So that would be one connected factor.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I could show you examples where that is not. So then my next question along these lines is, at this point in time, or up to this point in time, who has been in charge of enforcing these 50-foot buffers on public waterways?
Representative Torkelson, I'm going to have you hold on to that one. You're off topic now, and I had Representative Fisher ahead of you. So
that's fine.
We'll go back to you next. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some questions going back as we were talking about the ditches before when you were talking about the work that was being in there, Mr. Jaski. And the questions I have is you're doing a lot of things that not only take care of the ditch, but also it sounds like helping address water quality in the process. Do the organizations take a look at what the water quality measurements are before and after to see what kind of impact things are having? Are you able to measure that? And if you do, how do you quantify that and track that going forward?
Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher, there are a number of conservation projects that are being installed, as part of enhancements to ditch systems. There's, bioreactors where the water is filtered through, wood chips. There are, as Representative Hansen talked about, side inlet controls where you catch the water before it gets to the ditch, treat it, and then pass it through to the ditch system, either through a pipe or, in some cases, through a saturated zone that you build into the buffer. And these are practices that have had, a good bit of research and testing done, so we can predict, quite accurately what the benefit's going to be, looking at the watershed area, the soil types, and what's coming in. And there's been some edge-of-field type monitoring at the really, really small scale by Department of Agriculture in those practices. The Discovery Farms program has done some of that. I could get you more information on that. I don't have it with me today about what the actual measurements have been, but the projected benefits are done through research work.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I'm asking is because I know that up in the metro area where I've seen some projects happening where they've been addressing ditches, et cetera, they're able to, or correcting erosion, they're able to quantify what they're able to do in terms of reducing phosphorus, nitrates, all those type of things coming through the watershed. And it'd be kind of nice to know, you know, where we're making progress and where we aren't, and who's being part of that. When I hear that you go in and you evaluate who's all benefiting from it and bring them together, I think that's an important part, because we know we've got these goals that we'd like to meet, and it's nice to know what are the consequences. We're making these kind of investments. You know, we're seeing lots of money being invested here. It'd be kind of also nice to know what is the return that's coming back from the in these other areas that are helping us out in water quality, et cetera.
Director Jaski, comment.
Mr. Chairman, and I'll show a few examples in our presentation a little bit later on that, but, you know, you're writing about this. You know, ditch systems aren't just a rural Minnesota issue. They're an urban area, too. You know, if you look at the northern metro area particularly, there's a number of ditch systems that are providing drainage benefits to allow development to occur or to be able to function. One thing that they have in the metropolitan area is the ability to integrate the laws of the urban area for drainage and water quality and flood control. We don't quite have that in the rural part of the state because of the statutes, but you point to an example. Rice Creek Watershed District, for example, is doing some of those very things, and they are, you know, on a purposeful pursuit of integrating those three responsibilities. It's not easy, especially when you've got a kind of a flat landscape, right, but they're doing that, and there are some good examples. We should highlight some more of those.
And Director Jaski and Representative Fisher, you and I both live in two of the six counties in the state of Minnesota that actually have current 100% compliance with a 50-foot buffer. Both Washington County and Dakota County are two of the other four are rural counties, if I remember correctly, Dodge, Olmsted, and Ottertail, is that one? Yeah, there's a couple other ones, Grant maybe County, one of the other ones. Representative Torkelson, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was getting to the point of jurisdiction, you know, who is responsible for enforcing the existing buffer requirement on public waters.
Director Chairman, Jaski. It's through the shoreland zoning ordinance, so it's the county or in some few cases a city.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what's your impression of the degree of enforcement to date?
Mm-hmm. Director Jaski.
Mr. Chairman, I would say it's inconsistent, just because we've got, you know, a half dozen counties that have been doing it systematically. Others have not. You know, as was mentioned earlier, even with 100% enforcement, you know, you're not going to see a buffer strip on every water course or every ditch system. The laws don't require that currently. But I would say, with the 50-foot buffer, the half dozen counties that have done it have shown that it can be done, and I think others are, you know, probably waiting to see what's next.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. Well, and of course, as you noted earlier, the amount of work to be done in any individual county varies greatly across the state, depending on the landscape and the features that are incorporated into that county.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Director Jaski.
You know, Ottertail County, which the chairman mentioned, is, you know, on a longer-term plan, because they've got a huge amount of water resources in their county that to evaluate, and they're doing it systematically and carefully. And as someone mentioned earlier, you know, it's important that when they do that, they don't, you know, make landowners ineligible for federal farm program opportunities to enroll in CRP and things like that. So that's why it's very important how they do it, as much as, you know, what they're doing. And each of those counties that have done that successfully have integrated, you know, that communication, that option to comply with by enrolling in a program, and then the conservation aspects that need to be done through an enforcement mechanism.
And Director Jaski, thanks for taking so much time to go through this, because I anticipate that we're going to be hearing from the governor on his specific proposal. And I think it's interesting in the discussion we've had so far to understand Representative Hansen's been intricately involved with the drainage working group. It seems like that group is the natural folks to be coming back to with the discussion of buffers, and they work hard to reach consensus on tough issues around drainage and buffers and all that. So I hope that the governor, and I know you're intricately involved in that with Commissioner Landwehr, understand the successes of the drainage work group and the role that they can play in really bringing all the different interest groups together on this issue that is need to have more done on it so that we can move forward. With that, Director Jaski, I think what I'll do, it's probably going to take you at least 15 minutes to walk through the rest of it. Mm-hmm. Why don't we let you walk through in an organized fashion, and members, if you see a need to ask a question, do raise your hand. Otherwise, I think the director would be able to get through, and then we can have questions at the end. But if anybody does want to ask a question along the way, let Ms. Sipko just raise your hand, and if you want it right now, just nod to her, and we'll stop him. Director Jaski.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members, I'll keep going here. We've got, we talked about the local water management programs, and I'll highlight a little bit later, you know, the idea of moving towards a watershed approach among the counties, so water districts and watershed districts. I'm just going to go right to the budget here first. These are the numbers for the conservation programs that are passed through from our agency to local governments. You can see over the last four or five biennium, the rust-colored or red-colored bar chart shows the money that gets passed to soil and water conservation districts as a state contribution to their organizations. The Red River Basin Commission is an international organization that we pass the state's funding through to. Other states and you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Manitoba, the province, also provide a similar level of base funding that's been very effective to coordinate work in the Red River Valley that is going across proposals in the Clean Water Fund. This just indicates that we have an abundance of good information to work from. We have reports for clean water. We have reports for conservation. We have, you know, the science that has been invested in by the state of Minnesota is something that we very much pay attention to and use and ask our local governments to consider when they prepare their watershed plans or water management plans that drive the decision making for which things need to be done first and provide the most benefit, to Representative Fisher's point. So we have the science. You know, I mentioned it previously, but I want to make sure that everyone understands that the work that the PCA in particular, DNR to some extent, is doing to monitor and assess our watersheds is being used by local governments to integrate that science into their action plans. The PCA has done a really good job of taking what was a federal responsibility, in my opinion, and turning it into something much more useful than that for Minnesota. It's more important to make, you know, the use of this information for Minnesota's purposes than it is, in my mind, to give it to EPA and hope they do something with it. So the PCA has done a good job of turning that into something very useful for action in Minnesota.
Director Jaski, I want to remind, we have a number of new members. If I'm not mistaken, the lower left, is that Dr. Schwackhammer's report that was done about 4 years ago? Is that the cover?
Mr. Chairman, that is. That's the Minnesota Water Sustainability Framework, and Dr. Schwackhammer at the University of Minnesota was the lead author of that.
Okay. Director Jaski, I'll have Ms. Sipko email that out to committee members so they're aware. That was done about 4 years ago. I believe it was the LCCMR, about a $750,000 grant. Folks here may not be aware of that. Continue, Director Jaski. And then I see you're going to move into the Clean Water Fund.
Yes.
I'm assuming these are the governor's recommendations, not the council's recs. And if you don't mind, as you're walking through, if you've got some increases in yours over the clean water recs, could you also remind us what they are, if you know them by heart? Otherwise, we did hear it yesterday. Continue, Director.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, yeah, and there are other, you know, reports at a watershed scale that are, you know, that where all the science and the detailed modeling and benefits and so forth are found. But these are some statewide reports, and you recognize the one that was done, you know, a few years ago that had both some science and some ideas about policy changes as well. In the Clean Water Fund, just prepared, and it lines out a number of specific appropriations, and I can go through each of these, but maybe what I'll do, Mr. Chairman, is just highlight, as you requested, the ones that there were something different than what the Clean Water Council recommended. I should point out that the agencies certainly participated in the Clean Water Council process. One of the things that you've heard from us before, and I hope you'll hear again, is that we've tried to build this proposal to integrate the various components so they work together well. I think one of the common denominators between the council and the governor's recs are that there is a increased attention to implementation, to projects on the ground, to improve our water resources or protect them where they're already in good shape but are threatened with some other outside factors. I'll go down the list here. I think the first one that's different then is the second one on this list, the surface water, drinking water protection grants. This is the largest line item. This is the category of funding that is allocated through a competitive process. Actually, all these dollars are allocated competitively, and that's it's a good thing because we are certain to get, you know, the best projects submitted for funding. You know, the downside to it is that a lot of effort is put into putting proposals in, and in the end, only about 20% of them get funded. And so the way the Clean Water Fund is set up, we can only pay for work that actually results in a project on the ground. We, you know, don't have the ability to pay for work that is in preparation for that. And so I'll show you a bar chart in a little minute just showing that the demand is, you know, greatly exceeded the supply. The other line item in here that's slightly different is the Targeted Watershed Program. Let me see if I can get that on. I'm sorry, it's the... Let me skip ahead here. That program is also slightly different than the Clean Water Council recommendations. Let's see, where is that on here? Nonetheless, that one is slightly less than what the Clean Water Council recommended, and that's one where we've put a lot of money into a watershed in the hopes of making a difference in a very short period of time. Actually, Rice Creek Watershed District was one of the recipients of that in the recent allocations. We've also provided funding to the Crow Wing Soil and Water Conservation District and the Cedar River Watershed District and some others to invest in a four-year effort to try and clean up a water or a watershed or sub-watershed in a short period of time. The buffer item was also slightly different. The Clean Water Council had recommended, I believe, $15 million, and our recommendation from the governor was $12 million. Now, there's still some more work to do. Certainly, you know, we expect that there will be some budget adjustments and or proposals that are coming forth as we develop the policy on the buffer initiative, which you haven't seen yet. So that's still a work in progress, as is the Wetland Conservation Act policy piece, which will have some fiscal connections as well. So we will come back to this committee, Mr. Chairman, when those two pieces are ready for your consideration. I can go through this in more detail, but I wanted to hit on a couple of things that, you know, were asked about earlier. One was the FTE estimates that Representative Uglem asked about. We have no increases in the general fund FTE component because there's no increases in the budget. In fact, the 1.8% will cover a partial adjustment to, you know, salary and other inflationary costs. The Clean Water Fund is a zero-based budget, so this is the number of FTE that the governor's budget proposes to be lined up with that funding that's in his recommendations. And for our agency, that total is, I think it's about, you know, $98 million. And that, again, 90% of the money is going out to local governments to do projects on the ground. We use some of this fund to make sure that we're covering the grant agreements, the audits, the, you know, engineering review, the plan review that comes with this work. So that's the number that we have estimated for the upcoming biennium. And this shows a chart of demand versus supply in the competitive clean water funds. You can see over the last few biennium, what we do is we ask local governments to, you know, use their water watershed plans to give us the top two or three projects that are ready to go in the upcoming year. So they spend time doing that. They put together proposals. They're put into a scoring system, ranked, reviewed, and validated, and then they're then ranked and funded. You can see, though, that the good news is we get a lot of interest and there's a lot of work to be done. The bad news is, of course, that, you know, one in five actually get money. You know, someday down the road, we'd like to think about a process where we could be more predictable in providing these funds to local watershed plans and the organizations that are doing that work. As I said before, there's a cost to to do all of the preparation work to apply for a competitive grant program, and certainly that's been very successful, but it's also caused some frustrations, you know, with those local governments who, you know, don't have the funding necessarily to go put together a proposal, and then, you know, and then doing so, not getting anything back for their efforts. So we'll have to keep working on ideas to address that and be more efficient with our process. Here's a few projects that we can highlight that have been done already or underway. And these are, you know, we've got many hundreds of these we could show you, but here's a couple. This is a project in metro area, Lake McCarran. You know, they've got a problem with phosphorus, and so this particular grant, $360,000, is going to reduce phosphorus over, you know, the course of its lifespan, 45 pounds a year, and you're going to get 39% of the way towards the goal of what this lake needs in terms of phosphorus reduction. So in theory, if we do two more of these, this lake's taken care of, right, at least for this particular pollutant. Here's one in Wadena County in central Minnesota, and this one's got several aspects to it. It's $91,000. These grants go out, and, you know, they're not monster grants. They're, you know, relatively modest. This project is one where we're going to do actually three things at once. I mean, you're going to reduce the amount of water coming out of the groundwater source. We're going to provide a more efficient, you know, operation for this producer who's going to not have to pump as much because they're, you know, costs to pay the, you know, utility company to get the water out of the ground. And finally, it's going to reduce the amount of nitrogen that's going to leach into the groundwater, because when you apply it on the surface at the right time, you know, the plants will use the nitrogen that's being carried in water. If you do too much water at the wrong time, it can cause it to be leached away and wasted. So you're getting three benefits really here all in one project. You're saving groundwater volume, you're protecting it from being polluted, and you're giving this landowner a better way to, you know, manage their operation. Here's one, Little Rock Lake. This is in Benton County. If you drive up Highway 10, you know, you'll see this off on your right going north. It doesn't always look this bad, but this lake has definitely got a phosphorus problem. And that's the result of it there, is the algae problem that you're seeing here. And this is a bigger problem, a little bit bigger money. And, of course, you know, we don't get as far towards the goal in one project. And that's okay. You know, a sustained effort to improve that we're really trying to achieve here. This project gets us 11% of the way towards that watershed plan or that lake plan that says we need to reduce phosphorus. This is one in northeastern Minnesota in Carlton County. This is a project on an area where they have serious erosion because of the way the glacier placed red clay very near the surface in this part of the state, and that red clay is easily eroded without cover on it. And in some cases, in the past, they had built structures to hold some water back so it wouldn't wash away and enter the St. Louis Estuary, which is the upstream part of Lake Superior. This area is being stabilized to reduce that sediment delivery to the estuary. It's also, part of it is the trout stream, so we had to be careful that the design was done so that it would, you know, not hinder and hopefully improve the trout habitat. Obviously, you know, diminishing the sediment, in this case, a water quality problem, is also a habitat benefit, because clean water and aquatic habitat are very much, you know, linked. And again, these projects are all over the state, various forms that, you know, we can certainly provide you more details on those. Many of them are on our website. The LCC website also has information about most of these. By now, we feed that data to the LCC, and they post this information for all the legacy projects as well. So I'd be happy to share any more of those details with you anytime. I want to highlight the watershed approach I alluded to earlier. You know, as most of you know, our state is divided up on geopolitical boundaries by county and cities, and we know that managing water on a watershed basis is going to be, you know, more effective generally, but it requires some coordination certainly between those county boards and their staff, and the soil water district boards and their staff, and watershed districts too, where they're involved. So we have a pilot program underway to do that based on some policy that was passed by this body a couple of years ago. I think Representative Torkelson was the lead author on it, and before he, others were also helpful in getting this in place. We've got a pilot that's got four watersheds around the state, the Red Lake River up in northwestern Minnesota, the Lake Superior drainage up in Lake in Cook County, the Crow River, actually we have five, the Crow River in central Minnesota, the Root River in southeast, and then this Yellow Medicine River watershed in southwestern Minnesota. So we have five watershed projects underway to develop a plan of action that will be used by all of those local governments that are doing this work in each of those watersheds. And so over the next 10 years, we'll go from over 200 plans down to about 65 or so that will be commonly owned and used and executed by those governments on a shared basis. And the counties and the watershed districts and the soil and water conservation agencies have worked very, very hard to build something that they all believe works well and they all can support. We mentioned easements earlier, and we are working on a proposal to the U.S. Department of Agriculture to try and get some of their farm bill money. The new farm bill was passed in February of this past year, actually, it was March. And they have something called the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, where they can allocate a chunk of what would otherwise be CRP dollars to a state-led effort. And this is something that we're working on now, as we have generated a tentative proposal to a USDA, and we're going to be working on the details of that in the next few months. We covered some of this already. Soil loss and soil health are really soil in Minnesota. You know, our combination of soil, which we have, a great resource under our feet that we often, I think, neglect. It's some of the most productive soil in the world. We also have some of the best fresh water in the world. Those two things in here in Minnesota are things that we have to take very careful care of, because they're going to be the most precious commodities in the planet someday, I believe. And you can see here we've got soil being planted without tillage. You know, this idea of no-till planting is becoming more understood and I think used in Minnesota. It's we have a little bit more of a challenge in some of the Midwestern states south of us because of our climate, certainly, and you can't do it everywhere on all soil types, and it takes some specialized equipment, certainly. And so hopefully more of that can be done, because here you've got a situation where you're growing soil and you're saving energy by getting the crop in without having to till it, and you're going to provide water quality benefits at the same time. And that soil organic matter growth helps productivity. It also helps hold water in the soil profile, during rain events. We also have to make sure that soil isn't overly saturated, though, when the crop needs to go in, too. So that's why we have drainage systems. In the lower left, you see this picture I've shown before where, we need a conservation practice, or probably should have had one already that isn't there, and it can be remedied, but it's going to be much more costly to fix that problem than it would have been to prevent it in the first place. The buffers, we talked about this already, maybe a couple more examples to highlight, and these are just examples because, there's thousands of them. Each one's unique, as Representative Ferguson talked about. In the upper left, you've got a buffer that really is, built for, water quality and habitat. You can see the diversity of plants in that site. I mean, that you don't need that level of diversity just for water quality benefits, but if you want habitat, for birds or pollinators or anything else, you need some diversity of the plant community, and that's the one where this landowner has, volunteered to be part of a program and enrolled this area. In the lower left, this is a ditch system. This is a ditch that actually is something called a two-stage ditch, where you have some of the buffering benefit actually inside the channel itself. It's not the ordinary practice where you have the buffer on the outside of the channel, but different techniques, different designs can work to different effect in different places. And here the channel, you can see it's meandering, which provides some water quality treatment. It also provides some flood attenuation, because the water takes longer to get downstream when it has to take a longer path. And you can see here we've got vegetation that's, as was described earlier, the inside banks are highly vegetated. The water stays within this channel. It doesn't leave the channel. It's designed to hold a very large flooding event. That's why it's so wide. It's a two-stage ditch system. And the right, of course, is a problem site that we've seen before, where you know, the landowner is farming right into the water practically, and this, you know, isn't something any farm group or any landowner would condone, but this is sometimes what happens when someone's not paying attention. I don't have any more details about who it is or any of that. I hope that they'll find a better way to do it next year. Wetland Conservation Act, we hinted at that a little bit earlier. There is some policy work underway, and it's really targeted to trying to achieve better wetland mitigation. When a wetland is drained or filled with permission through a review, they can't avoid the wetland being drained or filled. What happens then is there's an offset called wetland mitigation or replacement, where you put a wetland back someplace else. And that has generally worked very well. We've had a wetland banking system in Minnesota since the mid-90s, one of the first in the country and by far the largest and most well-developed. But one of our current challenges is we've got, you know, northeastern Minnesota is very wetland-rich, always has been and probably, I mean, always will be. You know, some parts of those counties up, you know, Cochise County and others are, you know, more wet than dry. And we have some large-scale impacts that are going to happen in northeastern Minnesota there. You can't just, you know, impact a wetland and then go make one next door. It's not possible. So what do we do about finding the best places to put a wetland somewhere else that will do the most good ecologically and otherwise for the long term? And so one of the key ideas that we've been centering in on is something called an in-lieu fee mitigation option, where a project proponent or landowner can basically pay for someone else to take care of that mitigation through a federally and state approved mechanism to do that offset, called an in-lieu fee alternative. And that's the key part of what this policy work is that we've got almost finished, and we'll have some more to share with you on that in weeks ahead. And then I'll just conclude, but, you know, adding up these projects over time certainly is where we're at. You know, one by one, week by week, month by month, watershed by watershed, we make the improvements. And again, our projects are really focused on the private land. This map shows the private land in Minnesota. And as the chairman alluded to, you know, that land is someone who cares about it, and they are often going to be able to work with a local person to achieve a conservation benefit that the public can get something out of on that property in conjunction with those local partners. And this shows the impaired waters of the state or streams with the private land ownership overlaying on that. Mr. Chairman, that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Director. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jansky, this is something that you and I have talked offline about a little bit, and I just wanted to clarify a question that I've had. In Crow Wing County, as you know, we have a watershed district. It's approximately 7% of Crow Wing County in terms of its land mass. And over the years, there's been some question in regard to its necessity. And I believe some time ago, maybe before your or my time, there was a petition put together, and the process was put together and followed to dissolve the watershed district. And at that time, my understanding is that Bowser turned them down. And so my county has asked, is there a published procedure? I've looked online and I see there is a procedure for establishing a watershed district. It's about 5 pages. I'm wondering if maybe we're missing something. I'm clear on the statute, but we don't want to go through that process again, only to be turned down again. So is there criteria? And if there isn't, could that be published in a way that we could look at that and understand what your expectations are?
Director
Jess.
Chairman, Representative Heisman, I believe we can do that, yes. It's not a regular occurrence, and so we haven't, I suppose, published it because people haven't saw the need for it, but we certainly can put something in writing that describes what you're asking for, and we'll share that with you.
Next I have Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jasky, we've had some conversations about the 404 permitting and so forth, too, and I'm hoping that at some point we can come back, even before bills are heard, to have some discussions about just exactly what's going on there. If it's up to the, obviously up to the chair, to have that discussion so that people understand what's going on with the Army Corps and the 404 permitting and the delays and all that stuff. So hopefully you'll be prepared for that, and we can move forward either on the assumption or just on the feasibility study. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hancock. Trying to read the...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and
I need my glasses.
Director Jasky. Just a little clarification on the wetland banking. Is there a difference between a wetland banking? I see we have 10,200 credits. I'm assuming what we've done is we have some wetland banking that's been overseen and designed and regulated by Bowser. When there is wetland mitigation, I'm assuming there's also some mitigation that's done that's site-specific as opposed to a wetland bank. Is the authorization then for site-specific creation different standards than a wetland bank? And who administers those standards and who's in charge of that operation?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hancock, there is a difference. The on-site mitigation, you know, is done typically by the project sponsor that's draining or filling the wetland. So it's someone both draining and filling a wetland and mitigating or replacing one, all under the same authority. The way that's done is through a local government approving that, or as Representative Fabian indicated, the federal government may also be involved in that. In the case of mining projects, the DNR is the decision maker on that. So that's the three parties that would have some responsibility depending on the location of it. The other difference is that we don't have a conservation easement on the site. It's handled sort of ad hoc by possibly a deed restriction or by some other arrangement that the project proposer and the regulatory authority work out.
Follow-up, Representative Hancock.
Thank you. In looking at the easements restored, 243,000 acres, do you have any idea of what the split would be between wetlands and grasslands?
Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, I could look into it a little bit more carefully and get back to you, but I would say the majority of it's wetland. There is a perimeter of a buffer that can be included. Oh, I'm sorry, you're talking about the conservation easements now, I believe, not the mitigation. Okay, if it's the conservation programs under the rim, it would be probably somewhere around 2 acres of grassland for every acre of wetland. We do take a larger perimeter there for the habitat value. For the wetland mitigation sites, it would be probably more like half to one.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Hancock. Okay, thank you. Last question, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were talking about the slide, wetland ownership within the 80% pre-settlement wetland zone, and you talked about development of a new program that had like a four or five word label that involved, and it just sort of went past me. I didn't quite understand.
Director Jim.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, yes, it's an odd word. I wish there was a better one, but it's called INLIEU, INLIEU-FEE program. And that's what the federal government uses, and what they mean by that is you can, in lieu of making a wetland yourself, you can pay an authority to do it on your behalf. So it's in lieu of doing it yourself, you pay a fee to have someone else do it. So in lieu fee program is the way the federal government has codified it in their regulations, and we would be wise to make sure that what we do is going to be consistent with that. So we're using the same terminology.
Follow-up.
And so, Mr. Chair, when you say someone do it on your behalf, is it still on their land or in this zone, or what does that mean, do it on your behalf, sir?
Yeah. Director Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hausman, it would not be on your own. It would be in some other place that authority had permission to do it, and it would be, the way we're looking at it, in a place that would do the most good, the most ecological good, and achieve that offset as most effectively as we could.
Thank you. Director Jasky. Thank you for sticking around. Members, we're adjourned until Tuesday.